Instead, he focused on helping others, including me. When I was with him, he brought out the best in me. When I left him, I wanted to be like him and bring out the best in others. Coach never talked about himself, but in every one of our sessions, all I could think about was him, his wonderful qualities, his values, his consistency, his kindness. I was aware of the gap between where he was and where I was. But he always made me feel that I wasn't too far behind him. That always encouraged me and made me want to improve. Humility is essential in connecting with people. It took me a while to learn this. In my younger years, I would ask God to help me be successful, but secretly I hoped that people would think I did it all myself. I possessed more human frailty than humility. To help me, God gave me a dream bigger than myself. It was so intimidated that I only had two choices, give up or get help. I chose to ask for help, which at first felt very humbling, but I quickly discovered how much I needed other people, and as a result, my leadership actually got better, not worse. Good leaders are aware that they need other people, and they let them know that. There really is no downside. It keeps the leader's ego in check. It connects the leader with the people on the team. It draws the team members into the center, and it better enables them to fulfill the vision. So, if you want to be a connector, acknowledge your shortcomings and need for others, and be willing to ask for help. Number two, curiosity. Ask people questions. I know I'm known for asking questions. Whether I'm at dinner with friends, taking my grandchildren on a trip, or leading a business meeting, people know I'll be asking them questions. But I got my start as a questioner by asking myself questions. One of the things that stirred me to start asking myself better questions was Bob Buford's book, Halftime. He had an important question for someone who is middle-aged, which I was at the time I first read the book more than 20 years ago. His question, what kind of a second half are you going to live? Buford wrote, you will not get very far in your second half without knowing your life mission. Can yours be stated in a sentence or two? A good way to begin formulating one is with some questions and nakedly honest answers. What is your passion? What have you achieved? What have you done uncommonly well? How are you wired? Where do you belong? What are the shoulds that have trailed you during the first half? These and other questions like them will direct you toward the self that your heart longs for, and they will help you discover the task for which you were especially made. These questions helped me at midlife to set myself up potentially for a good second half. Today I'm in my 70s, and I haven't stopped asking questions. I'm still curious, and I want to remain that way. Why? Because without asking questions, I can easily become comfortable and stagnant. Entropy can easily set in. I would start to accept the status quo without asking, is there a better way? I would fail to recognize opportunities. Too many leaders don't ask enough questions of themselves or others. This happens for a variety of reasons. They assume they have the answers. They value what they think more than what others think. They prioritize directing others over understanding others. They don't recognize the need to find common ground. They don't understand that questions help to manage expectations. I want to take a moment to address this final point. As leaders, we must manage expectations all the time. We have to deal with expectations that we have of ourselves, expectations we have of others, and expectations others have for us. Any time our expectations or those of others don't align with what is actually happening, there are problems. In fact, I believe that disappointment is the gap between expectations and reality. How do we close that gap? By asking questions so that we can adjust our expectations. Knowing the expectations I have of myself makes me more self-aware, which paves the way for me to improve myself and become better. Knowing the expectations I have of others makes me better able to communicate with people and face reality. And knowing the expectations others have of me makes me better able to lead them. All of those connections are made when we use questions to build bridges with others. Number 3, effort. Go out of your way to connect with people. Oprah Winfrey said, "The big secret in life is that there is no big secret. Whatever your goal, you can get there if you are willing to work." That is certainly true in connecting with people. You have to make the effort. My grandson John started taking golf lessons when he was 12. After months of lessons, it finally became time for him to play on a golf course, and I wanted to be the one to take him. Before we began, I said, "John, I want you to try to get a par on one of the holes. If you're able to get on the green and putt for a par, I'll take a video of you taking the shot and dropping the ball into the hole. That way, we can show it to the family." For 2 days, we played golf and worked on getting John his first par on the golf course. Every time he putted for par, I pulled out my phone and I videoed him 4 different times. He got on the green, had a chance to putt for a par, and missed it. But late on the second day, on the 16th hole, John attempted his par putt and rolled the ball into the cup, and I had it on video, the first par he ever made. We celebrated on the green. Then I immediately shared the video with the rest of the family right then and there. I also got a picture of John holding up his scorecard, proudly showing off his par with his arm around me. Now, why did I do that when it was so much work? Well, first of all, it was fun. But more importantly, I wanted to make a meaningful memory with my grandson. It's something both of us will always remember, and it created a special connection between us, one that will last well beyond our time on the golf course. I've done a variety of things to connect with people over the years. For about 2 years, I hosted intimate dinner parties at my home with people Margaret and I wanted to connect with, so we would focus on relational side of things. I hired my writer, Charlie Wetzel, whose first career was a chef, to be cooking for us. Once or twice a month, we'd ask 3 couples to join us for a 5-course meal, where the only agenda was connecting and enjoying one another's company. We spent a lot of time deciding who we wanted to attend those meals. For example, Ann Byler, the founder of Auntie Ann's Pretzels, had always wanted to meet Truett Cathy, her idol. So we arranged for Ann and her husband, Jonas, to have dinner with Truett Cathy and his son, Dan. That was a very memorable evening. Every relational connection starts with the decision to make the effort to connect. It ends with what I call the mirror test. Can you look into the mirror and say to yourself that you did your best? If so, you have passed the test. As my friend Art Williams said, all you can do is all you can do, but all you can do is enough. If you care about people, you will be capable of coming up with ways to create connecting experiences with them. But it will take effort, and it will take even more effort to follow through on those ideas. But if you don't, you're not really doing all you can to connect or to become the best leader you can be. Number 4, trustworthiness. Be someone others can count on. People do not connect with someone they don't trust. They connect with someone they can count on. Author and speaker Simon Sinek addressed this issue when he said, "People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it." The why deals with the motives. Those motives come from the heart, and they play out as trustworthiness if the motives are good and right. As a leader, I know I have to keep my motives right. If my primary motivation is to add value to people and help them, then all is good. If not, I'll get off track, and I'm continually aware that to remain trustworthy in the eyes of others, I have to work at being continually successful in 3 areas. 1, integrity in my life. 2, consistency in my actions. And 3, competence in my work. Now, when I do these things well, I become more trustworthy and am able to connect with people and build the relationship. When I fail in one or more of these, I lose trust and have to work to regain the trust I've lost. Because I'm only human, I do fail sometimes. How do I regain lost trust? By following this process. I fully acknowledge that I have done wrong. I explain exactly what I'm going to do to try to make things right. I give others an opportunity to share their perspective and add anything to what I shared with them. I do the work to fix the problem. And then finally, I follow up with them to confirm that the problem was fixed to their satisfaction. The bottom line is that I do what I can to make it right. And trust me, I've had to do this too many times to count, but it works. And it's always amazing for me how forgiving people are when I follow this process with them. What's even more amazing is how often the relationship is strengthened and improved. It's often even better than it was before. I think there's a valuable lesson from this about trustworthiness. We often lose trust and connection with one another, not because of an occasional failing, but because we neglect to take the right steps afterward to restore the relationship. Don't allow that to happen to you. Make the effort to be trustworthy, and when you fail, do what's in your power to make things right. Number 5, generosity. Give first, give continually. Albert Einstein said, "A person first starts to live when he can live outside of himself." It could also be said that a person starts to give when he lives outside of himself. And giving is a good way to connect with others. Roger Breland, Dean Emeritus of the Alabama School of the Arts, demonstrated this to me at a conference where we were speaking together. He pulled me aside and gave me a beautiful Mont Blanc pin as a gift. It was out of the blue. I was so surprised. "I want you to have it because you're a special friend," he said. "And I also have a request. Every time you write with that pin, would you pray for me?" I gladly said yes. And for over a year, I used that pen at my desk, and every time I did, I prayed for Roger. His generosity to me and my prayers for him increased our connection as friends over time. I've never known a stingy person with a scarcity mindset who is able to connect well with other people. They are too often self-driven and make decisions based on self-preservation. As theologian Henry Nouwen said, "When we refrain from giving with a scarcity mentality, the little we have will become less. When we give generously with an abundance mentality, what we give away will multiply." A few years ago, I came across a transcript of a commencement address given by author Stephen Keen to the 2001 graduating class of Vassar College. As you might expect, it's written eloquently. In his address, he talked about money and generosity. That human life is brief when placed in time's wider perspective is something we all know. I'm asking you to consider it on a more visceral level. That's all. What are you going to do? Well, I'll tell you one thing you're not going to do, and that's take it with you. We came in naked and broke. We may be dressed when we go out, but we're just as broke. Warren Buffett? Going to go out broke. Bill Gates? Going to go out broke. President Ferguson? Going to go out broke. Steve Keen? Broke. You guys? Broke. Not a crying dime between you. And how long in between? How long have you got to be in the chips? Just the blink of an eye. Should you give away what you have? Of course you should. I want you to consider making your lives one long gift to others, and why not? All the other stuff you have is just on loan. All you want to get at the getting place, from the Maserati you may dream about to the retirement fund some guy will try to sell you sooner or later, none of that is real. All that lasts in this world is what you pass on. The rest is smoke and mirrors. Giving isn't about the receiver or the gift, but the giver. It's for the giver. One doesn't open one's wallet to improve the world, although it's nice when that happens. One opens one's wallet to improve oneself. I give because it's the only concrete way I have of saying, I'm glad to be alive, and I can earn my daily bread doing what I love. I hope you will be similarly grateful to be alive, and that you will also be glad to do whatever it is you wind up doing. Giving is a way of taking the focus off the money we make and putting it back where it belongs, on the lives we lead, the families we raise, the communities that nurture us. So I ask you to begin the next great phase of your life by giving, and to continue as you begin. I think you'll find that in the end, you'll get far more than you ever had and do more good than you ever dreamed. Wow. Generosity makes you a better person. It helps you to become a better leader, and it paves the way for you to connect with other people. If you're not already someone who gives first and gives continually, then I encourage you to try it. Number 6, listening. Open the best door to connecting with people. I once read a story about a tennis pro who was giving a lesson to a new student. After watching the student take several swings at the tennis ball, the instructor began to suggest ways the man might improve his stroke. But every time the instructor made a suggestion, the student interrupted him with his own diagnosis of the problem and how he might fix it. After being interrupted yet again and again, the pro simply nodded in agreement and let the player continue on his own. When the lesson was over, a woman who observed the lesson, was familiar with the pro, and had seen the whole thing, asked, "Why do you go along with that arrogant man's stupid suggestions?" The old pro smiled and answered, "I learned a long time ago that it's a sheer waste of time to try to sell answers to a person who only wants to buy echoes. If you never listen, before long the people around you will stop talking to you, and you'll become isolated as a leader. If you do listen, not only will they tell you things you need to know, but they will also connect with you because they see that you care and that you value what they have to say." It took me a while to learn this myself. As a young leader, I was like the tennis student who didn't listen. My highest priority was expressing my ideas and convincing others to buy into them, not listening to feedback or learning what others had to say. After a series of leadership misses, I recognized the problem in my unwillingness to make listening a priority, and I began shifting to do things differently. But it was hard-fought. I struggled to change, but I eventually succeeded, and here's how I did it. I made a list of the negatives of not listening well. The first thing I did to get on the right track was sit down with my legal pad and list the ways not listening was hurting my leadership. At the top of the list, I wrote the following. Few people had anything to share with me. My leadership was based on assumption. My ideas were the only ones being implemented. No one was taking ownership of tasks except me, and my team lacked connection. I could see that this was not a recipe for success, and this evidence helped me to want to change and make the effort to do things differently. I reminded myself daily to listen well. Most leaders spend a lot of time in meetings. That was true for me at the time I was trying to change. I decided that every time I would meet with someone, and I mean every time, I would take out a legal pad to take notes, and I would write a large letter L at the top of the page. That L stood for listen. It was my reminder to shut up and listen. I stopped interrupting. That brings me to my next point. I had to stop interrupting people. I used to do it because I was focused on what I wanted to communicate. And I also often thought I already knew what others were going to say. But interrupting someone is like saying, "What I want to say is more important than what you're saying." That was wrong. I needed to stop doing it. I started asking questions. One of the ways I stopped myself from interrupting others was to start asking questions. I found that one of the best ways to invite the other person to talk. I've already discussed the value of asking questions, so I don't need to say much here. But I will say this. I discovered that my ears never got me into trouble. I invited people to hold me accountable for listening. My final step in the process was to ask others to let me know any time I wasn't listening to them. There's nothing like accountability to keep you honest. Whenever anyone called me out for not listening, I apologized, closed my mouth, and listened. If you want to be a connecting leader, become a better listener. Invite others to hold you accountable. If you have the courage, meet with your team members, colleagues, friends, and family, and ask them how good a listener you are on a scale of 1 to 10. If your score is low, you might need to take the same steps that I did. Number 7. Encouragement. Give people oxygen for their soul. Over 20 years ago, I read an article about encouraging leaders, and in that article was an illustration that has continued to stick with me. One of the more obscure exhibits in the Smithsonian Institution displays the personal effects found on Abraham Lincoln the night he was shot. They include a small handkerchief embroidered A. Lincoln, a country boy's penknife, a spectacle case repaired with cotton string, a Confederate $5 bill, and a worn-out newspaper clipping extolling his accomplishments as president. It begins, "Abe Lincoln is one of the greatest statesmen of all time." Why would our nation's 16th president carry around a clipping like that? History remembers Lincoln as a folk hero and a president's president. Was Lincoln an egomaniac? Hardly. When Lincoln was president, he wasn't as popular as he became after his death. The nation was bitterly divided, and Lincoln's leadership was constantly threatened. He was the object of a critical press. So Abraham Lincoln needed something in his pocket to remind himself that his critics were not his only observers. So he carried this icon or the symbol of affirmation, something that reminded him that someone believed in him. As leaders, we must never underestimate the value of reminding others that we believe in them. If even the greatest of leaders needed encouragement, then everyone does. That's why George M. Adams called encouragement oxygen for the soul. When you interact with others as a leader, what is your mindset? Is your intention to correct them or to connect with them? Do you keep them down or lift them up? You have that choice every day with those you lead, with those who lead you, with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you're a fan of the Lord of the Rings books or the movies and of The Hobbit, you might be surprised that their author, J.R.R. Tolkien, required the encouragement of a friend and fellow writer to keep him going in the early stages of his works on those books. C.S. Lewis and Tolkien used together, along with a few other friends, in a group they called the Inklings. They met weekly to share what they were working on and encourage one another. Tolkien credits Lewis as the person who kept him going when he felt discouraged. In an article about the two writers, Mark Morine said, "Had it not been for Lewis, Tolkien wouldn't have written The Lord of the Rings." Tolkien wrote in a letter, "The unspeakable debt I owe him cannot be fathomed. For long, he was my only audience." Several times, Tolkien really threw in the towel, and each time Lewis said, "Tollers, where's the next chapter? You can't give up now." Lewis was the only one who kept him going. Everyone in your life could use the encouragement that only you can give. At home, I've always tried to provide encouragement first to my children and now also to my grandchildren. When my daughter Elizabeth was young, every Thanksgiving, I would offer to pull the turkey wishbone for her. If you're not familiar with this tradition, here's how it works. Two people each grab at the end of the wishbone and make a wish, and pull until the bone breaks. Whoever ends with the larger part is the winner and gets his or her wish. What Elizabeth didn't know was that I always looked over the bone beforehand and made sure to give her the part that would make her the winner and have her wish come true. One Thanksgiving, after a succession of years where she always won, she said to me, "Dad, you never get to make a wish and have it come true. What do you wish for?" "My wish is that you always get your wish." She gave me a big hug when she realized I wanted what was best for her. She was encouraged, and so was I. I always take the mindset of encourager onto the stage when I speak. As a communicator, I can either try to be a sage on the stage or a guide by their side. A sage looks down at others and tries to impress them with wisdom. A guide comes alongside others, shares the journey, and encourages them to go the distance with him. I don't want to impress others. I want to connect with them and help them. Billionaire investor and philanthropist Charles Schwab said, "I have yet to find the man, however great or exalted his station, who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than he would ever do under a spirit of criticism. I believe most people are under-encouraged. You can correct that deficit by becoming an encouraging leader." Changing from directing to connecting is one of the most valuable shifts you will ever make as a leader. When you direct, it's like building a bridge to others, but the traffic only goes one way. When you connect, it's a two-way street. And because of that, everything improves. Not only are relationships better, but ideas improve because they're flowing in both directions. People work better together and the team gets stronger. Problems get solved more quickly because communication is better and people know one another and they start pulling together. And the environment improves too. Will it take time to build these connections? The answer is yes. But don't let that stop you. In the long run, you'll save time. Your team will get better, and so will you. As I read to you today the Directing to Connecting chapter, I have to go back to that thought of humility. I talked about that, of course, with John Wooden, but I just want to say that in my life I have found that when I began to humble myself and allow people to see not only my strengths but my weaknesses, it immediately makes an emotional connection. The other day I was in a meeting, a very important meeting, with about 10 of my top leaders from four of my companies, and I was casting vision for the next several years, and it was very essential that the vision message was clear and hopefully contagious. And I came through a process of talking about vision where I said that a leader needs to ask himself or herself certain questions as they get ready to cast that vision. And one of the questions I talked about was this question: am I the right leader? And I looked at my staff, I looked at my leaders of leaders, and I said to them, the vision that I'm about to share with you it's very big. It's way above me. It's way over my head. And so I'm asking myself as I'm getting ready to cast vision to you, am I the right leader? Do I have what it takes to take us to the next level? I've never been there myself. I'm not sure. It was a magic moment in our meeting. Because before I ever cast vision, I showed them that I was questioning myself as being the right leader. Not because I lack confidence, but because I have to realistically say I've never been there before. I could feel the connection in the room. I could feel them emotionally move toward me, emotionally embrace me, even before the vision was given. And it reminds me of what I teach in the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership, and that is people buy into the leader before they buy into the vision. And the greatest way for them to buy into you is for you to be a person of humility, a person that understands that without the team, it's not going to be possible to reach the goal. Without a tremendous amount of teamwork, it's not going to be possible to reach the goal. And it all begins by me looking at you and me looking at my team that day and say, I need you. In fact, I can't get there without you. I close that session by saying to them, one is too small of a number to achieve greatness. So this vision requires a big dream, and it requires a big team. Too often, we have a big dream and a bad team. And, well, that won't get you to your vision. That's not a dream. That's a nightmare, my friend. But as I looked at my team, I was proud of them. I knew that they know me. They know my strengths. They know my weaknesses. And they're not there to compete with me. They're there to complete me. Why? Because I connected with them and said, I need you. Try that, my friend. Try that. The next time you get your group together, Let them know that you need them. Connect with them by humility. I promise you, they'll love you, and then they'll let you lead them. Chapter 9. Team Uniformity to Team Diversity. The Improvement Shift. Our differences can make a positive difference. Of all the leader shifts I've made, this required the greatest leap. I say that because there is nothing diverse about my background. I grew up in Circleville, Ohio. It was in the middle of the country. The community was almost entirely white, and my family was lower middle class. There was nothing cutting edge about the church I grew up in. We were conservative and old-fashioned. Even the theological and ministry training I received at college in Circleville emphasized that Christians should separate themselves from the culture of society in some ways. We set ourselves apart, and we are comfortable spending our time with people just like us. My early days as a pastor were equally vanilla. The church I led was filled with farmers and their families. They were good-hearted, hard-working, salt-of-the-earth types of people. But they were not diverse or forward-thinking. While I was at the church, NASA put the first man on the moon. The people in my church were not convinced that it actually happened. Many believed it was a hoax that had been staged in the desert in the American West with a trampoline placed underground and covered with sand. Really? Yes, really. All the leaders in the church were old white men. They all seemed to be cut from the same old cloth, adhering to the same old rules, following the same model of leadership. They even looked like one another. As a pastor, I was expected to conform to the way other churches in our organization operated and follow all of the same rules and guidelines that everyone else did. As I already mentioned in Chapter 6 on the Abundance Shift, the emphasis was on tradition and conformity. When it was time for me to hire my first staff member, the advice I received was to try to find a John Jr., someone exactly like me. Their concept of progress was moving backwards slowly, and their idea of innovation was more of the same. Getting outside of the bubble. The improvement shift from uniformity to diversity occurred slowly for me. The seeds were sown for it while I was still in college. It started because I was coaching a basketball team at a Catholic school. This was my first exposure to a long-term interaction with Catholics, and at that time, I also met the first priest that I ever got to know, Father Mike Elifritz. He was wonderful. After I was done coaching and I was getting ready to graduate from college, I had lunch with Father Mike. I shared with him some of my apprehension about the next steps that I would be taking in life. I'll never forget what he told me. John, trust your future to God. Those words helped me to become more confident as I moved into the next phase of living. Now, why were these words so significant? After all, I was a person of faith who was actually going into ministry. They resonated strongly with me because a Catholic was adding value to me, a Protestant. In my small, sheltered world, that wasn't supposed to happen. Those two groups stayed on the opposite side of the lines and were suspicious of one another. But his heart and support changed my thinking. It was catalytic for me and started to show me a bigger, more diverse world. Now, that occurred in 1969 and was the start of a long journey toward the appreciation of diversity that would take almost 30 years. Along the way, there were a lot of experiences that challenged my narrow, naive thinking, and a lot of lessons that I learned. Here are the headlines from just a few. A lifelong farmer taught me my greatest leadership lesson. Claude, an unassuming, ordinary, middle-aged farmer from rural Indiana, helped me learn that leadership isn't position, it's influence. An impoverished woman taught me generosity. Helen, a member of my church, exhibited an extraordinary spirit of generosity and showed me that it had nothing to do with wealth. A non-leader taught me not to pigeonhole people. Brent, who modeled servanthood to me, Help me understand that a person didn't have to be a classic leader type to make a valuable contribution to an organization. A large church leader showed me how to go from shepherd to rancher. Jerry, the pastor of a large church, helped me to understand how to equip people to become leaders, grow my small church, and think like a rancher who pioneers and builds, not just a shepherd who maintains a flock. A speaker helped me understand that my way wasn't the only way. Florence, who wrote a book about the four different temperaments, helped me appreciate the differences and the strengths of people unlike me. A layperson gave me the idea to raise money. I had thought the best ideas related to church leadership came from vocational ministers, but Bill, who was a businessman, was the one who came up with the idea of raising money for a church building program ourselves instead of borrowing it from the bank. Now, there are hundreds more people, different from me, who made a positive difference in my life. They challenged my assumptions, changed my thinking, showed me better ways to do things, helped me to remove my prejudices, taught me to value everyone, and made me a better person. Slowly, I moved from valuing sameness to questioning its value. Diversity slowly marked me with this thought. People different from me could make a positive difference in me. This shift, which started subtly and grew over time, culminated when I relocated myself and my companies to Atlanta, Georgia in 1997. Atlanta is a city rich in African-American influence and history. That was new to me. I lived in a small town in Ohio, rural Indiana, and sunny San Diego. I knew there was a gap between me and the African-American community and their experiences, and I wanted to close that gap. To help me, I enlisted the assistance of my friend Sam Chan, the president emeritus of Beulah Heights University, a predominantly African-American institution in Atlanta. Sam was born in India, but he was well-connected in our community. He arranged lunches every other month for 2 years, where I got to meet more than 300 local leaders. Overall, their journey was different than mine. I asked a lot of questions and requested that people tell me their stories. I'm happy to say that I was able to connect with most of the people I met. They reshaped my attitude, challenged my thinking, and touched my soul. I became a better person because of these experiences, and I made many new friends. The advantages of team diversity. I saw a definition of team in the Harvard Business Review that I really like. A team is a small number of people with complementary skills who are committed to a common purpose, set of performance goals, and approach for which they hold themselves mutually accountable. This definition assumes that there is a variety of skills. That implies diversity. Our differences really can make a difference in our teams, our organizations, and our individual lives. Once we find common ground and commit to bring the best out of people who are diverse, good things will begin to happen. This is what I'm discovering now. Number one, diverse teams fill in the knowledge gap. As a leader, it's important to know what you don't know. How? By engaging with diverse people on your team. If you include a variety of people, then someone on your team will be able to help you. That's why I frequently ask members of my team, "What am I missing?" I assume that I'm always missing something, and I believe someone can help me. When they do, then I'm freed up to focus on what I do know and what I do well. When you don't fill in the knowledge gap, you can end up like the professor in this old story that I read. He was traveling by train with a farmer. After several days together, they were tired of talking and reading, so the professor suggested they play a game of riddles. "Every time you miss a riddle, you give me a dollar, and every time I miss a riddle, I'll give you a dollar," said the professor. "Well, you're better educated than I am," said the farmer. "I'll give you 50 cents. The professor agreed, and the farmer made up the first riddle. "What has three legs walking and two legs flying?" he asked. The professor didn't know, so he gave the farmer a dollar. The farmer didn't know either, so he gave the professor 50 cents. Number two, diverse teams fill in the perspective gap. Malcolm Forbes said diversity is the art of thinking independently together. I love that, because getting good independent thinkers to work together is the leadership challenge that I love tackling. When everyone thinks and says the same things, it's the end of creativity and the death to an entrepreneurial environment. As a leader, it is my responsibility to encourage and engage in conversations that draw out different perspectives. I don't need or want any team members to parrot back to me what I think or try to guess what I want. I want to know what they think. I want my team to take me on when they see things differently. I want them to challenge me just like I challenge them. It is only then that we get the most out of one another. That's called win-win. Number three, diverse teams fill in the experience gap. A little bit of experience outweighs a whole lot of theory as far as I'm concerned. The greater the differences in personal experiences, the greater the team's ability to achieve and the greater number of tools the team has at its disposal. As the saying goes, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Diversity helps prevent us from hammering away at things that need a screwdriver approach. Good leaders embrace diversity in their teams. The topic of diversity is not a simple one, and the people have a wide variety of reactions toward it. For some people, it conjures demographic studies, awkward interactions, relational minefields, and diversity training sessions in the workplace. For others, it represents good old boy networks, glass ceilings, and privilege. But good leaders see diversity as one of the best ways to build a world-class team. When properly led, motivated, and unleashed, a diverse group of professionals can give your leadership team an uncommon advantage over your competitors. One of the most impacting leadership books I've ever read is A Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin. It tells the story of Abraham Lincoln's presidency and how he created his cabinet from a highly diverse group for its time. The members of his cabinet were his fierce rivals, not allies. Why did he choose people who were so different from himself? The demands of the Civil War required Lincoln to harness the skills of the best leaders and thinkers if the Union were to succeed. And President Lincoln used his greatest leadership skills and political insights to get the most out of the people holding different perspectives in the cabinet. The book made quite an impression on me. When I finished reading Team of Rivals, I wrote these words inside the front cover. If you ever have to handle tasks of difficulty and diversity, lead during a crisis, place yourself beneath the burden of a higher cause, carry the mantle of leadership with dignity, then read this book. Barriers in Diversity. The greatest of leaders seem to do this instinctively. Winston Churchill, who masterfully led the United Kingdom during the difficult years of World War II, brought political adversaries like Clement Attlee into his strategy meetings in the underground bunker in London. Churchill knew the crisis demanded extraordinary talent, not just the skills of people he would be comfortable with. Yet, if inviting diversity is such a valuable practice, why don't more leaders embrace it? Because diversity is uncomfortable. Many leaders fail to deal with that discomfort and have a difficult time overcoming these common barriers to diversity. Number one, fear conflict. A diverse team will naturally possess differences of opinion, perspective, and worldview. That almost inevitably leads to conflict. Many people are afraid of that, yet it's a necessary part of life. Conflict can actually help us. Author and consultant Patrick Lencioni wrote about this in his book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. All great relationships, the ones that last over time, require productive conflict in order to grow. This is true in marriage, parenthood, friendship, and certainly business. Unfortunately, Conflict is considered taboo in many situations, especially at work. The higher you go up the management chain, the more you find people spending inordinate amounts of time and energy trying to avoid the kind of passionate debates that are essential to any great team. Lencioni teaches that productive conflict has one purpose, to produce the best possible solution in the shortest period of time. When different people with different experiences sharing different opinions all sit at the same table with the same objective, you can produce extraordinary results. But it requires people to set aside their titles and positions, personal agendas and preferences. Everyone must want the best idea to win, not just their own or their group's. A marriage counselor once shared something with me about resolving the conflicts in marriage. People usually enter a marriage with different personalities, different experiences, different perspectives, and different expectations. Whatever differences existed before the wedding are intensified as the couple lives together for the first time. But happy marriages are based less on compatibility and more on how they deal with incompatibility. Rather than allowing the relationship to get tied up in knots, they need to learn to loosen the knot a bit, to face and resolve conflict. Unhealthy conflict takes differences personally, where healthy conflict sees differences impartially. Unhealthy conflict dumps personal baggage. Healthy conflict desires to know the person, including that baggage. Unhealthy conflict searches for retaliation. Healthy conflict searches for resolution. Unhealthy conflict results in hurts, and healthy conflict results in helpfulness. Unhealthy conflict seeks quick conclusions. Healthy conflict, it seeks understanding. Unhealthy conflict holds back from the conversation. Healthy conflict becomes part of the conversation. Unhealthy conflict values self above solutions, whereas healthy conflict values solutions above self. If you are in unhealthy conflict, you begin to defend your territory. If you're healthy in your conflict, you open up new territory. See, unhealthy conflict, the bottom line is, makes teams worse. Healthy conflict, it makes teams better. What people often fear most are breakdowns, and that our irreparable harm may occur in relationships. But when you value diversity and are genuinely open to the ideas and insights of other people, you open up the possibility of discovering fresh ideas, building a better team, and taking new ground. Number 2, insufficient personal network. Most people spend time with others like themselves. That often isn't out of prejudice, it's just how people act. When I was growing up, my mother used to tell me, "Birds of a feather flock together." She said it because she wanted me to spend time with other boys of high character, not kids, who made bad choices and got into trouble. But the old adage she used to quote also is an indication that people naturally gravitate toward others of similar background, age, and race. I recently read an article about Cheryl Moses, the founder and CEO of Urban Media Makers in Lawrenceville, Georgia, which is not far from the John Maxwell Company headquarters. While planning an event to celebrate the 16th anniversary of her organization, Moses read a study that said 75% of white Americans don't have any non-white friends and 65% of African Americans don't have any white friends. Those statistics struck her so hard that she decided to turn the anniversary celebration into an event called "Come Meet a Black Person." Said Moses, "How can you learn about a person if you've never had that person in your life?" The event was well attended, and Moses thought it was a start toward a conversation between two groups that too often keep apart from one another. Take an honest look at your peers, friends, and colleagues. If most of the people you know look like you, vote like you, and listen to the same music as you, you probably need to put some work into expanding your network, as I did when I moved to Atlanta. I've also taken other steps to expand my network. When I was a pastor, I spent much of my time outside of the church networking with and talking to pastors. After I transitioned out of full-time ministry, I started spending time with more business people from a wide variety of industries. I connected with Kevin Turner when he was at Walmart, Dan Cathy, the CEO of Chick-fil-A, Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta, and many others. And I've traveled a lot more internationally to learn about different regions and cultures, from Venezuela to Nigeria to Saudi Arabia to the Philippines. And I can't even count the number of times I've been to China. All of this has stretched me. It's made me a better person and a better leader. If you need to expand your personal network as I did, keep these things in mind. Expanding your network requires humility. When I started my leadership career, I thought that I was always right. My greatest discovery as I started to meet people unlike myself was that they had so much to offer. Before making the improvement shift, I had shortchanged myself. Realizing that was humbling. When I recognized that others knew what I didn't, and they had as much to contribute as I did, I could leave my world and enter new ones. Instead of fearing loss, I was anticipating what I would gain from our interaction. Expanding your network requires intentionality. If you wait for connections with dissimilar people to happen on their own, they will never happen. You need to get out of your own natural flock and migrate to where the other birds live and work. It will be uncomfortable, and anything uncomfortable or unusual must be done with high intentionality. Expanding your network requires energy. Anytime you try something new, it's going to take extra energy. That probably seems like common sense. However, people don't plan for it. If you want to make your team more diverse, gear up for it. Plan to keep going when you're too tired or don't feel like moving forward. Expanding your network requires time. The same can be said of time. It will take time to build a diversified team. On top of that, it will take time and energy to see the benefits of diversity. You'll need to demonstrate patience as you start the diversity dance, where you take two steps forward and one step back. It will take time for people to get to know one another. Everyone won't play nice at first. You'll encounter speed bumps and detours. That's true of any good team. But can you get there? Yes, if you give the time and energy required. Expanding your network requires love. This one may be a surprise, especially in a business context, but I'm going to tell it like it is. Love makes all things work, and the foundation of love is being willing to value people, including people different from you and people you don't like. I've discovered that the more I value people, the more I add value to them. And the more I add value to them, the more value they return to the team. What gets appreciated, appreciates. Number 3, unwillingness to deal with prejudice. I didn't grow up trying to isolate myself from people who are different from me. I just didn't know many. When I did eventually seek out relationships with people who were different, as I began connecting with the African-American business community in Atlanta, I discovered that I possessed a passive prejudice about people who were unlike me. Because of my ignorance, I had a blind spot. I assumed that people like me had good ideas that worked better than anyone else's. Exposure to different people from different backgrounds revealed my prejudice. There's a saying I came across that really opened my eyes to what happens when you are prejudiced. I don't know who said it, but it's true. The world is like a hand, and all the people its fingers. If you hate and destroy one group of people, you lose a finger, and the grasp of the world is less. Embracing diversity has allowed me to have a better grasp of the world around me. One of the best ways I do this is through the John Maxwell team. The team's thousands of coaches are a mosaic of diverse people from a broad range of countries, more than 100, each with its own culture. These coaches bring their different perspectives, gifts, and experiences together that provide us with a bigger picture and greater opportunities. Let me tell you about 5 of them. Gabby is from Paraguay. She has been the catalyst for transformation in her country. Sorin is from Romania and leads more than 1,000 coaches in that country who daily add value to many citizens. The Fong from Nigeria trains people in leadership for the United Nations. Rudolfo, who lives in Houston, has translated all the John Maxwell team training materials into Spanish so that they will benefit millions of people in Latin America. Dr. Saroja, in Saudi Arabia, teaches 27,000 high school students leadership values. Now, these are only five fingers, but I know many more. I could fill this chapter with the names of difference makers from various countries, but that's not the point. My perspective has been changed. Does yours need to be? What prejudices, whether conscious or unknown, do you possess that are keeping you from connecting with people unlike you and diversifying your team? You need to identify whatever is holding you back and work to resolve it. Number four, arrogance. I once read that the knights of the Middle Ages used to own a variety of horses for different uses. They rode smaller horses called palfreys or amblers for everyday use such as traveling. But when dressed in full armor, ready for battle or jousting, knights needed massive war horses called coursers or destriers, which could support the weight of a rider, his armor and weapons, a saddle, and the horse's extensive armor. Those horses might have been as many as 20 hands high at the withers. For those of us who aren't horse people, that means 7 feet tall at the horse's shoulder. Now, why do I mention this? Because that's where the expression, get off your high horse, comes from. A mounted knight in full armor looked down on everyone else, not just the peasants on the ground, but even others on horseback. And that's what many people do, especially leaders who have achieved a certain rank. They arrogantly look down on others from their high horse. This prevents them from appreciating others, particularly those who are different from them. Some leaders are so confident in their own genius that they can't imagine other people adding value to their work. They believe the less similar others are, the less they can contribute. And sadly, the further down in the organization people are, the more they are ignored. But the reality is that no leaders are so good that they can afford to ignore the contribution of others. No one is indispensable. Years ago, I came across a poem by Saxon White Kessinger called The Indispensable Man. I thought it expressed the plight of the arrogant. Some time when you're feeling important and some time when your ego's on blue. Some time when you take it for granted you're the best qualified in the room. Some time when you feel that your going would leave an unfillable hole. Just follow this simple instruction and see how it humbles your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water and put your hand in it up to the wrist. Pull it out, and the hole that's remaining is a measure of how you'll be missed. You may splash all you please when you enter. You can stir up the water galore. But stop and you'll find in a minute that it looks quite the same as before. The moral in this quaint example is to do the best that you can. Be proud of yourself, but remember, there's no indispensable man. If you dismiss the ideas and potential contributions of others, especially of those offered by people different from you, you will never reach your potential, and neither will your team. And sadly, you will never even know it. Number five, personal insecurities. There's an old joke that the CEO of an organization met one day with the head of HR and said, "Search the organization for an alert, aggressive young leader who can step into my shoes, and when you find him, fire him." Just as the CEO in that joke felt threatened by strong young leaders, there are people who feel threatened or uncomfortable around them of those people that are different. That personal insecurity is easily sensed by others and puts them off. The topic of insecurity is a complex one, and if you're an insecure leader, you may need to get help in dealing with it. But I will say this. The best antidote I've ever found for personal insecurity is to think about helping other people and putting them first. When you do that, you stop worrying about trying to look good, and you put your attention on making others look good. I learned this lesson a couple years after graduating from college. For 2 years, I played on a good amateur basketball team where all the players in our starting lineup were better than I was, I have to admit. This intimidated me and made me feel a little insecure because I was a pretty decent player back in those days. At first, my competitive nature kicked in during our practices, but that